At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
On the program today, when smaller might be better, how you might get kids to eat better, and how to make your podcasts better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 25th of May. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Bigger, we are told time and time again, is better in life and in capitalism. A spinoff of the spun-off Hewlett-Packard would like us to believe otherwise, though. Last year, the foundational Silicon Valley company split itself in two, its personal computer and printer business into HP Inc., whose CEO we had on the program the other day, by the way, and its business focused on corporate clients branded as Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. Today we learned HPE, as the ticker symbol goes, is going to further spin off its IT services business. Marketplace's Annie Baxter walks us through the spin-off strategy.
In the past decade or so, Hewlett-Packard picked up a lot of other companies, big firms like computer maker Compaq and tech services firm Electronic Data Systems. Peter Cowan is with Clear Capital Advisors, an investment banking firm in the technology sector.
It looks like Hewlett-Packard has not been on the forefront of innovating or coming up with ideas, but merely trying different businesses to attach, bolt on, and then get rid of as they move forward.
Last year, Hewlett-Packard spun off its enterprise business, which included IT consulting. Cowan says those kinds of services can be useful, a kind of Trojan horse that companies use to make inroads with clients.
That segues to them then being able to sell additional software, hardware, and other sorts of custom products.
But he says HP Enterprise didn't make its IT services work as well as other big companies like IBM have. And IT services are costly, according to Crawford Del Pret, chief research officer at IDC. He says there's a lot of expensive human capital involved. And IT services are hard to scale.
You have a certain number of people that you need to deploy on a project. Then you sign another project, and guess what? You have to deploy another 1,000. And that means hiring them.
HP Enterprise will now focus more on stuff like servers and cloud infrastructure. Jeff Sonnenfeld, Senior Associate Dean of the Yale School of Management, thinks the move makes sense.
As society's needs change and consumer interests change, you have to move with it all and adjust to the changed world.
Sonnenfeld says the benefit to investors with these spinoffs, they get shares in better focused businesses. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
A kind of amazing thing happened in the Congress of the United States last night. A bill passed the House on a vote of 403-12. Remarkable when you consider the level of animus in the corridors of power. For the first time in 40 years, Congress has updated the rules on chemical safety. The Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976 has been criticized for its weaknesses in consumer protection. The new bill is expected to pass the Senate this week and will eventually, when signed by the president, give the Environmental Protection Agency some new powers. Ashley Montite has that one.
A lot of people are jubilant about the passage of this bill. Richard Dennison is a senior scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund.
This is a really big deal.
He says it's the first major environmental legislation to pass in 25 years. And he says it went through because the damage chemicals can cause affects everyone, no matter their political stripes.
People know someone who got breast cancer at an early age or who was unable to conceive a child. Those are the kinds of effects that we're concerned about chemicals contributing to.
He says take trichloroethylene. It's used in spot cleaners the general public and dry cleaners use, and it's a known carcinogen. He says now the EPA can go after the uses that cause the most harm. Even the chemical industry is relieved about the new rules. Cal Dooley heads the American Chemistry Council. He says consumers were losing trust in chemical products.
We felt that by giving EPA greater access to information that our companies would produce, that would allow them to make a more affirmative determination of the safety of our chemicals in commerce.
In other words, it's about business. The industry's had to contend with stores taking matters into their own hands, refusing to stock certain plastics. States have also brought in their own regulations. Melanie Benesch, an attorney with the Environmental Working Group, says one problem is the EPA isn't getting enough funding. The chemical industry is kicking in $25 million to help pay for chemical reviews.
So for an industry that's reported close to $40 billion in profits, that's really pocket change.
She says to do the job right, the EPA is going to have to rely on Congress, which has often opposed the agency. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but oil's bumping back up against $50 a barrel, $49.56 at the close in New York. That's what happens when production falls, as we have been reporting since the price started sliding a year plus ago. All right, raise your hand if you've seen a Windows phone in the wild recently. Yeah, I didn't think so. That helps explain the announcement from Microsoft today. 1,850 layoffs in its smartphone division. Hardware never really was a favorite of new-ish CEO Satya Nadella. Microsoft shares up 1% today on that news. The wider market's up about the same. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Since the beginning of this fiscal year, that is, since this past October, the United States has resettled nearly 40,000 refugees. Only about 2,500 of them, though, have come from Syria. The State Department does say it's still on track to accept the 10,000 Syrian refugees that President Obama promised to take in this year, but there is a whole lot that happens between a promise and delivery. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson dug into the bureaucracy of refugee allocation.
Mia Witte is sitting in a big conference room in New York with a view of the Hudson River. Bright green cardigan, big green eyes. She sets a handful of neon highlighters on the table and cracks a big binder.
91 pages this week.
With information of all the refugees that have been newly approved for resettlement in the U.S.
And it gives us the bare bones information of each refugee's case.
Nationality, ethnicity, religion, how many family members, whether they've been tortured, whether they have a medical condition, whether they know friends or family already in the U.S. Each family becomes a case number, a row on a spreadsheet, their story a series of coded abbreviations. Witte points at one.
PA is principal applicant, WI is wife, 2MI is two minors, and then survivor means survivor of torture.
While abroad, these refugees have already gone through interviews, medical exams, security screenings, and now it's time for a new home. Every Wednesday each week, Witte, who works for Church World Service, meets colleagues from eight other agencies contracted with the State Department. And they go through and divide up that week's pool of refugees. It's a more bureaucratic version of picking teams on the playground. This particular week, there are more than 2,000 refugees ready for resettlement, about half of them Syrian. It takes 4 hours to divvy them up. To prepare for that meeting, Witte goes through the binder row by row with her highlighters. She starts with refugees who have a friend or family member already in the U.S. Generally, more than half do. That's one of the biggest factors in determining where refugees might be placed.
I never took geography in school, but this is making me an expert. Okay, so Phoenix, Arizona is the first case, Congolese family.
Church World Service has an office in Phoenix, so she swipes this case line with a yellow marker. Then she looks at how many refugees that office has already resettled this year and how many they've committed to but haven't yet arrived. That's the second big factor in determining who goes where, who can take them, and a little bit of who wants them.
So, for instance, our affiliate in Richmond, Virginia, they have churches that are interested in co-sponsoring single mothers. So when they don't have a friend or family member here, when I see that there is a single mother, I can select that case just knowing that we can send them to Richmond, Virginia, and that they'll be co-sponsored by a church there.
And it really just depends on that moment, you know, where is their availability to help them?
Larry Bartlett is the director of the Refugee Admissions Office at the State Department.
People might know about California or Florida, place, or New York from overseas, but it doesn't mean those will be the best states for them to settle in.
Refugees don't get to choose the state or even the country where they wind up.
And it's actually an interesting issue because refugees really aren't in that way able to shop for a country that they think might be better. You know, Sweden has better social benefits than the United States.
It also takes the U.S. a year and a half to 2 years to process a refugee, screen them, get them ready to travel. That relatively long timeline means that if the U.N. has an emergency situation, they generally don't come to the U.S.
Our goal for this year is to achieve at least 10,000 Syrian arrivals, and we think that we're on track to do that.
That number is both too high or too low, depending on whom you ask. States like New Jersey and Kansas have tried to remove themselves from the refugee resettlement program. In November, more than 30 governors said they oppose settling Syrian refugees in their states because of security concerns following the terrorist attacks in Paris. But Witte says her networks are hungry to assist Syrian refugees.
There was just an outpouring of support from so many different people, so many different faith-based groups. And in the states where those governors were against them, people were coming out and saying, please send them here and we'll support them.
She says Syrian refugees are so requested, so in demand, that the 9 resettlement agencies used to limit how many each agency could select each week to make sure the Syrians were evenly divided. Witte says now that more Syrians are being cleared for resettlement, they don't worry about that as much anymore. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You don't have to be a parent to know that it's tough to get kids to eat healthy. I mean, who among our younger selves didn't turn up their noses at this or that fruit or vegetable offering? However, as with most things in life, tricks help. Researchers at Cornell University studied some elementary school kids at lunch and found that while kids who were given whole apples for lunch tossed them pretty much straight into the garbage can, if you give them apples pre-sliced, consumption went up by about 70%, consumption here being kids eating apples. Roberto Ferdman from The Washington Post wrote about it. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
It's tough not to start with a, hey, you kids, get off my lawn moment and ask whether we've now come to the point in this society where we need our apples pre-sliced before we eat them. But I'm going to start there.
I wouldn't say that we need our apples pre-sliced, but I would say that it certainly helps to pre-slice our apples, especially for kids. I mean, this is not necessarily a big deal for adults, but we've actually found, not just while researching this question, but then also in practice while selling pre-sliced apples, that children tend to eat their fruits, or at least this fruit, when it is served sliced, when it's served in a way that's easier for them to eat it.
There is some irony here, right? Because even aside from the research, we have McDonald's to thank for the popularity of pre-sliced apples.
That's exactly right. So in 2004, McDonald's started serving pre-sliced apples. And at first, they were optional. But then in 2012, McDonald's made them mandatory. They served them with all Happy Meals. And what we've seen is this huge increase in pre-sliced apple consumption. And it's tied largely to that.
Does the apple industry need this innovation? I mean, have they fallen on hard times?
The apple industry isn't exactly reeling, but apple sales have been kind of stagnant or falling for some time now, or had been leading up to when they started serving pre-sliced apples. Pre-sliced apples offer this kind of new product, and innovation in a mature industry is rare. So kind of happening upon this, thanks in part to McDonald's, was a welcome sign for the apple industry.
The analogy here is baby carrots, you write in this piece.
That's right. Baby carrots are, I mean, I could go on and on about baby carrots. baby carrots are this other bizarre example of...
First of all, they're not actually baby carrots, which I just learned like 5 years ago. But anyway.
They're not actually baby carrots. Baby carrots are shaved down whole carrots, and they were extremely important to the industry. In fact, they're credited with saving the carrot industry. Around the time that they were invented, the carrot industry wasted about 75% of carrots that were produced because they were too ugly to be served. So they were essentially being discarded, and baby carrots are whittled down ugly carrots. So not
it sounds
only
so
have
mean
they saved,
when you say it that way.
I mean, as far as I know, carrots don't have feelings. We can revisit this if
yeah, that's a whole different interview.
But baby carrots now account for 70% of carrot sales. That's incredible. And I don't believe, nor does the apple industry, nor do apple growers, that sliced apples, pre-sliced apples, will come to represent that sort of share of overall apple right. sales. But at the moment, they represent about 5% of sales, and there's reason to believe that they could represent quite a bit more, especially if there's a push to get kids to eat them, which there should be.
It's not all sunshine and light, right? I mean, these individual sliced apples come in individual little plastic bags, which then get wrapped in a bigger plastic bag. I mean, it's there's not all is great.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's concern that while this is a great innovation and a way to get kids to eat apples and reduce food waste, it's kind of this classic sign of our desire for convenience.
Right.
And in order to serve these pre-sliced apples, we need to put them in something. And in this case, it's plastic. And at a time that we're trying to reduce waste, that we're trying to reduce our use of plastic, the apple industry is increasing our use of plastic.
Roberta Ferdman writes on food and the like for Wonk Blog at The Washington Post. Roberta, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Coming up.
I just wanted to be able to make whatever shows I want to make and work with all sorts of different interesting people to help them make their podcasts.
Come on, you've got the new Serial podcast ready to go, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 145 points today, 0.8%, 17,851. The NASDAQ gained 33.7%, 48.94. The S&P 500 added 14.7%, 2,090 there. Express, the clothing chain, reported earnings below expectations, shares down 8.4%. DeVry Education Group is struggling, accused by the Federal Trade Commission of false advertising, and now the for-profit chain has booted its CEO. Shares down 13% today, 48% in the past year. Big banks led the markets up. Wells Fargo up 2.6%, Goldman 2.3% to the good. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.87%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's not often I've said the words Hulk Hogan and sex tape on this program. Never, in point of fact. But the most recent development in the lawsuit that Hogan, a.k.a. Terry Bollea, filed against Gawker kind of forces my hand. Today, a judge in Florida refused to throw out the $140 million judgment that Hogan won against Gawker over the leak of said sex tape. News, yes. Also news, though, are unconfirmed reports that Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel funded Hogan's case as well as others against Gawker. Thiel helped found PayPal. He was an early investor in Facebook, and he was outed by Gawker in 2007. Thiel is now open about his sexuality, but he is also, as of today, the leading example of Silicon Valley celebrities getting the same treatment the rich and famous in Hollywood or New York get and fighting back. Sally Herships has that story.
Let's be honest. We are used to hating on Wall Street. Silicon Valley, not so much. So the following comparison might sound a little surprising.
If Goldman is a giant face-sucking squid, then Google and Facebook are predator and alien.
Scott Galloway teaches marketing at NYU Stern School of Business. He says Silicon Valley and Wall Street are actually pretty similar. Both are made up of powerful companies focused on shareholders, so both should fall under the same scrutiny. It's just that the tech industry has some built-in advantages.
People feel more affection for their iPhone than their mortgage.
Galloway says Silicon Valley has done a better job branding itself than Wall Street. Thomas Ordahl is with Landor, the global branding firm. He says, just ask the average American to name a few Wall Street leaders, and many of us would have a hard time.
But if you ask them about Silicon Valley, they probably could come up with a few names quite quickly.
Steve Jobs, Sheryl Sandberg, Mark Zuckerberg, names that wield enormous power.
There's almost no part of society that Silicon Valley, writ large, doesn't touch.
Joseph Turow is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications. He says Silicon Valley represents an important institution in our lives, and so it's important for us to pay attention.
It's publishing society's most widespread stories. It's interfacing with the educational system, the security system, and Wall Street.
Turo says tech companies have begun to realize that to be players, you have to play. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The 2016 Gracie Awards ceremony was here in L.A. last night, honoring the work of women in media, including some Marketplace names you'll know, Lizzie O'Leary and Chrissy Clark. Also among the winners was BuzzFeed's Women of the Hour podcast, hosted by actress Lena Dunham and produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman. Producers, as anybody in the radio or audio or television business knows, are the ones who actually get things done. And Weiss-Berman is trying to do more things podcasting with her new company. It's called Pineapple Street Media, and we've invited her in to talk about the business of podcasting. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm usually on the producer side of the mic.
That's right. Well, welcome into the, you know, the quiet room.
Thank you.
I want to talk about you for a minute before we get to the business of what you're doing. You were at NPR. You were at WNYC. You've been working on podcasts. You went to BuzzFeed, had great success there. And now you're doing this entrepreneurial thing, branching out. Why?
That's a good question. I think it's a really amazing time for podcasts. It's just it's a really exciting time for the medium. And I just wanted to be able to make whatever shows I want to make and work with all sorts of different interesting people to help them make their podcasts. And it really is, I think, just the right time to do that.
When you're doing these consulting things, you're working with companies that want to get into podcasting because podcasting is the bomb now, right? Is that the deal?
Podcasting is the bomb.
Okay. So the question is, what's going to do you in? What's the threat? What's the existential threat to podcasting?
Oh, God, that's a big one.
If you can't see one, that's fine.
I'm trying to stay really positive these days about the
I get that. You got a business
industry
to run.
I guess the existential threat could be that the ad rates go down eventually. But they're going really well right now. And I think that we're seeing more and more big advertisers who just really, really want to get into this space because the return on investment is really high. There's a lot of trust between a podcast host and a listener. And a lot of podcast hosts really only want to use advertisements from companies that they actually really like. So I think it's pretty successful advertisement.
So it's everybody from, say, the New York Times, right? Because they've got all that content. But it's also conceivably like Procter & Gamble.
Yeah. So we're working a lot with media companies that have never done audio before. And that's kind of what I did at BuzzFeed. I started a podcast department there.
What does a podcast that Procter & Gamble, for instance, want you to do that's about like soap sound like?
It's an interesting question, and it's something that we would work with Procter & Gamble on if they approached us. I think a lot of what we want to tell people is that it is a great time for podcasts. Everyone's listening to them. They're kind of exploding. There are also over 325,000 of them on iTunes.
Right.
So if you want to stand out, you have to make a good show.
Is there such a thing as too many podcasts?
I don't think there's such a thing as too many podcasts. In order for podcasts to be successful, they don't have to have massive listenerships. So there might be someone who wants to do a podcast for what's like a niche podcast topic?
Well, how about like crocheting?
Yeah, there might be somebody who wants to do a podcast about crocheting, and they might be able to find sponsorship from a company that sells yarn, for example. And they might have 20,000 extremely devoted listeners who listen to the podcast and then go buy that yarn.
Do potential clients come to you and say, listen, I've got this great idea. I want to be the next cereal?
Almost every day. Yes. Yeah. And what we tell those people is Serial took a bunch of effort. It took many years and many incredible producers. But that's, well, I don't know how I want to say this. I'm glad this is edited.
So actually, we're going to leave that in there because and I'll tell you why.
Oh, no.
Because here's the next question.
Okay.
Seriously. everybody thinks podcasting is so easy. But it takes time, expertise, and discipline. There's a great quote from you that I read saying the way to make a great podcast is to go in and listen to it four or five times and then take out that stuff, kill your babies, basically. Take out the stuff you love to make the entire thing better, right?
Totally. So if I were talking to Procter & Gamble, yeah. I might say...
I'm pitching them now. This is, okay. they should be listening.
Yeah.
Here's how your soap podcast goes.
Yeah. I think that with all of the competition in the podcasting space right now, you want something that stands out and that involves good editing. It involves real resources, really finding interesting stories and interesting characters. For companies who want to get into podcasting, it's going to be less about getting massive numbers and more about their audiences being connected in a deeper way to the people who are behind the microphone.
Jenna Weiss-Berman is co-founder of Pineapple Street Media. Jenna, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd be remiss here if I didn't mention our podcasts, Actuality with the good people at Quartz, Codebreaker from Marketplace Tech, and our newest venture, The Uncertain Hour, courtesy of our Wealth and Poverty Desk. This final note on the way out today, not that the New York Times gets to decide everything, but the paper announced this morning that as of today, the word internet will no longer be capitalized. The Associated Press made the decision a month or so ago, so the Times is really just following on this one. I personally have been saying internet, lowercase I, for years now, but hey, this is radio. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 145 points today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 33.7%. The S&P 500, 14 points higher, 0.7% there as well. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. That's capitalized, by the way.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.